So, coming out of last night, perhaps a few people would just like to throw some themes that emerged into the center.
Desire and longing.
Desire and longing.
Mm-hmm. Patience.
Impatience. Yeah.
That's what I said. Change.
Living
fully, even
resisting
change.
Resisting change.
Going for the jugular.
Going for the jugular, yeah. Right.
Being open to the moment.
Standing still.
The importance of not being right.
Soul being her spirit and matter.
Stand still. It's hard with this microphone. That's right.
What mask have you taken on to get through?
Letting go of pain.
That was that one.
Dying before you die.
Not losing sight of the tree or the heart.
What a tree or a branch does is lost in you, then you are surely lost. Yeah. Direction. Seeking direction. Yes, Angelis. Angelis Ariane, who I recommend to your search committee for next year. She'd be marvelous. She's very busy. If she can make it, she'd be wonderful for this weekend. Is my microphone on, by the way? Can you hear it? We need a little more volume. If someone's listening on the other side, they have their actual studio on the other side of that room there, so... Well, that should be enough to go on with. I'm going to start with a poem called Faith from my second book, Where Many Rivers Meet. Because faith's interesting in that when you start with faith, you have none at all. Otherwise, why would you want faith? Why would you be searching for it? And there's something about faith that is never utterly fulfilled. To me, faith is almost the same quality as longing itself. And because faith is constantly, in some ways, being tested. But I wrote this poem, and a strange thing happened in the middle of it. But here's the poem. When I wanted to write this poem, I sat down, there was a blank page. And... already, you know, 2,000 years ago, the library shelves of Alexandria were filled with books on faith. So what was I going to add to it? As I started to write the first line, the theological library shelves of the world swam before my eyes. And I knew it was going to be a short poem. So what was it going to be? So the first line I said, I want to write about faith. You get your foot in the door in whatever way you can. No one can dispute that. If you ever want to start a poem, you just start with the line, I want to write about. I want to write about faith, about the way the moon rises over cold snow night after night. I want to write about faith, about the way the moon rises over cold snow night after night, faithful even in its fading from fullness. Faithful even in its fading from fullness, slowly becoming that last curving and impossible slither of light before the final darkness. But I have no faith myself. I do not give it the smallest entry. Let this then, my small poem, like a new moon, slender and barely open, be the first prayer that opens me to faith. I want to write about faith, about the way the moon rises over cold snow night after night, faithful even in its fading from fullness, slowly becoming that last curving and impossible slither of light before the final darkness. But I have no faith myself. I do not give it the smallest entry. Let this then, my small poem, like a new moon, slender and barely open, be the first prayer that opens me to faith. I want to write about faith, about the way the moon rises over cold snow night after night, faithful even in its fading from fullness, slowly becoming that last curving and impossible, faithful even in its fading from fullness, faithful even in its fading, faithful even in its fading from fullness, slowly becoming that last curving and impossible slither of light before the final darkness. But I have no faith myself. I do not give it the smallest entry. Let this then, my small poem, like a new moon, slender and barely open, be the first prayer that opens me to faith. Some ways for me, poetry is the art of overhearing yourself say something from which it's impossible to retreat. You're trying to force yourself to say things which you cannot go back on. The thing I couldn't retreat from in that poem was, what would it be like to have equal faith in the part of me that is fading away as the part of me that is growing at any one time? You take a step in and the images, the natural images of the body arise. Here it's the archetypical feminine image of the moon rising. You step in, you say, what am I going to write about? And suddenly, there's the moon. What's the moon doing there? Faithful even in its fading from fullness, slowly becoming that last curving and impossible slither of light before the final darkness. But I have no faith myself. I do not give it the smallest entry. Let this then, my small poem, like a new moon, slender and barely open, be the first prayer that opens me to faith.
What I'd like to work with this afternoon is the fading part of ourselves. Not because I think it's the only door, but because I think it's the disowned side of our psyches and the disowned side of our culture. And the part and quality around which we have not received what you call in the Zen tradition, we have not received transmission about. We have not had the eldership. Well, the eldership has not survived. And because of this, I feel like we've put tremendous amounts of psychic energy into defending against this area. And it takes the form of enormous amounts of emphasis on success and of being on top and of understanding power only through the understanding of power over things. So I want to look at what would it be like to ask the question about what is it like to have power through and in things, which is a different emphasis. Interesting, it seems to me that all the teachings in the poetic tradition, the mythic tradition, say that in any case, the ultimate initiation into power is powerlessness. So when you take the final step into understanding power, it will be a step of utter powerlessness. And that will be the final teaching around this area. So I want to look into this. I want to look at this afternoon. If you look at a rack of magazines in a news shop, in Grand Central Station, wherever you are, you get an interesting view of our psyches and the way they work. I first did this from an anthropological point of view when I first started working in the corporate world. Someone had this strange idea of inviting a poet in to work with some of the themes they were working with. And so, going into this world, I treated it almost as if I was visiting a kind of obscure foreign tribe somewhere. And I started looking at all these business magazines and saw a pattern there that's very strong, but I also saw it through all the other magazines, and that's the fact that the view and the emphasis is totally on who is on top of the compass pile at any one moment. Who has been successful? Who has won through? Very little. An exception if you had anything about the dark days people went through to get there, or about that section of the business world which must be sliding under at any one time into bankruptcy. No, it was the top 500 this, top 500 CEOs, top 500 companies, top. And you look at this at any magazine, it's true. The fitness magazines, women's magazines, particular images of women's bodies which stare back at you from the covers. It's almost as if I realized that this image from my poem, I suddenly got this realization, it's almost as if we were to say to someone else, listen, I like to go out of the house at night the first part of the month when the moon is growing. But I am not going out for the last part of the month when it's growing smaller. And I will certainly not go out when there is no moon at all. If someone said this to us, we'd think this was very strange. And yet, the way we've arranged our psyches, we actually say it every day, as far as our approach to life is concerned. Even our approach to death, you know, there's been much of the death and dying work as you realize sometimes that it's still an attempt to make a success out of death. And a refusal to take this final step into the initiation of power, into the quality of powerlessness. That may be the place actually where some ultimate understanding may reside. So to my mind, in the creative act, you know, when you finally get your studio arranged or your study and your paintbrush is finally hovering over the canvas, the yellow paint on the paintbrush, or your pen is hovering over the paper, and we suddenly can't write, even though you've set up all the outer accoutrements to do it. You're ready for the great American novel or the great American poem. You suddenly can't. The language we have for this moment is a creative block, but I don't think it's commensurate to the actual experience, because I think what it is actually an intimation of your own death. And the intimation is that you must be able to explore all sides of yourself in order to celebrate totally what you're trying to celebrate with your paintbrush or your pen. And at this point, the part of us that arranges things is exceedingly frightened by that moment. Part of us that tries to arrange our lives. Someone once said that life is what happens to you while you're trying to do something else, or you're trying to arrange something else. There's something very real about this. When Rilke was in his callow youth, and trying to write poems, and not doing a very good job of it, his early work isn't that much beyond the kind of 19th century Hallmark card. But he had the good fortune to go and stay with the sculptor Rodin, and he was there to write a monograph, an essay on his life. And it was a wonderful, fateful moment, because here was Rilke up in his bedroom, his study, trying to scratch out some lines on paper, while beneath, Rodin is working 15 hours a day. And in marvelous irony to the kind of frail scratch of his pen on the paper, there was the sound of cold steel on Carrara marble, you know, coming up from this veritable combustion engine of artistic production down below. And whenever he would go down and ask Rodin, well, what's the secret? How do you do this 15 hours a day? Incredible statues, you know, life. And all Rodin would say was, travailler, just work, just work. And he came down again. Rodin said, travailler, just work. Back to his pounding. And finally, he must have asked three times. In the tradition, you always ask three times. Turned away. First two times. Rodin told him to go down to the Jardin des Plantes, the small zoo in the center of Paris, and find an animal, any animal. Don't even think about writing. Just look at it. Look, 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 look. Watch, watch, pay attention. Until suddenly the moment comes when the animal is looking at you. And then write only when you can't do anything else. It's a wonderful counterpoint to this, because another time Rodin invited Rilke down later on. And he said, look, I want to show you something. And he had a statue covered with a tarp. And Rilke stood there waiting for this new Rodin sculpture to be unveiled. And then Rodin pulled the tarp off. And Rilke was totally astonished. It's like being there on opening night, see a Rodin statue the first day it's unveiled. And he saw, as we all do when you look at a Rodin statue, he saw the wrists and the hands and the fingers and the ankles. And he was caught by this one hand, and he said, oh, that hand. And in that moment, Rodin picked up a hammer and bang, knocked the hammer off. Moment worthy of a Zen master in the... I think what Rodin was saying was probably stop concentrating on technique. It's putting the cart before the horse, not just the hand. How do you look at the whole of something and resonate in that wholeness? Instead of trying to put together your experience from all these parts, if you can just look at the parts, you know, long enough and put them all and arrange them all, and this goes next to that and that goes next to that, and this is happening because this is happening. He says, no, look first. And what he's saying to Rilke is, if your poems are about art, about becoming a poet, about writing great poetry, then throw all the poems in the river, in the Seine, because it's all to no avail. What it's really about is this dance. You're bringing out the dance. You're bringing out the dance to remember. You're trying to remember yourself. And if you go to such a deep memory, you can help others remember too. But that's only a kind of gift that comes out of you remembering. There's a marvelous line by Seamus Heaney where he says... which is a kind of memory himself. He says, Then I thought of the tribe whose dances never fail. Then I thought of the tribe whose dances never fail, because they keep dancing until they sight the deer. And I thought of the tribe whose dances never fail, because they keep dancing until they sight the deer. So in some ways, Rodin is learning how to dance here. I know of an eminent... depth psychologist at the moment, who shall remain nameless, who's taking up tap dancing late in his life. Some ways he's... So Rilke goes down to the cage and he chooses the panther. I've been at third world zoos myself in the Far East, where you see this enormous cat inside a small cage, and the wooden floor has literally been worn away, because this enormous energy is going backwards and forwards inside the cage, just padding backwards and forwards. And the wooden floor has been worn away in a groove by this cat. Rilke wrote this poem. He said, Sein Blick ist vom Vorübergehen der Stäbe so müd geworden, dass er nichts mehr hält. Ihm ist, als ob es 1000 Stäbe gäbe und hinter 1000 Stäbe keine Welt. Der weiche Gang, geschmeidig starke Schritte, der sich im allerkleinsten Kreise dreht, ist wie ein Tanz von Kraft um eine Mitte, in der betäubt ein großer Wille steht. Nur manchmal schiebt er. Nur manchmal schiebt. From seeing the bars, his seeing is so exhausted that he no longer sees anything anymore. From seeing the bars, his seeing is so exhausted that he no longer sees anything anymore. To him, the world is bars, 100,000 bars, and behind the bars, no world. The lithe swing of that rhythmical easy stride that circles down to the tiniest hub is like a dance of energy around a point in which a great will stands stunned and numb. Only at times the curtains of the pupils rise, a shape enters, slips through the tightened silence of the shoulders, reaches the heart, and dies. From seeing the bars, his seeing is so exhausted that he no longer sees anything anymore. To him the world is bars, 100,000 bars, and behind the bars no world. The lithe swing of that rhythmical easy stride that circles down to the tiniest hub is like a dance of energy around a point in which a great will stands stunned and numb. Only at times the curtains of the pupils rise, a shape enters, slips through the tightened silence of the shoulders, reaches the heart, and dies. To me, this poem is a step of that ultimate step into powerlessness. In a sense, you know, on a surface reading, you go away saying this is a pessimistic poem. On a deeper reading, you understand this is this final step into the initiation into powerlessness, into power. That here you have this animal, which in some ways is at the top of the food chain. It's the part that can leap on things. The whole evolution of a big cat, of a panther, has been to the point where it at this point in its place in life, it runs at things, it sees things, it runs at them, it leaps on them, it kills them, and it eats them. That's being a panther. No guilt. No guilt about that for a panther. That's what a panther does. That's the pantherness of the world. But here in this cage, when the image of the prey enters, which ironically here is Rilke looking through the bars, it slips through the tightened silence of the shoulders, reaches the heart, and dies. Because the panther cannot complete the circle. The panther cannot leap. The panther cannot leap. In Black Elk's words, the sacred hoop is broken. If you look at Rilke's work, this is really his first step into the brokenness of the world. The exile of the world, the cage of the world, the Monday morning of the world. And the marvelous thing about this poem is that he does not say, now that I understand that I cannot leap, I can go on, I can write great poems, and here's da 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 da. The courage of this moment is that Rilke stays right there, reaches the heart and dies. Dann geht ein Bild hinein, geht durch die Glieder angespannte Stille und hört im Herzen auf zu sein. And the way Rilke gets to it, in the German you hear it at the beginning, he says, sein Blick ist vom Vorübergehen der Stäbe so müd geworden, dass nichts mehr hält. Ihm ist, als ob es 1000 Stäbe gäbe und hinter 1000 Stäbe keine Welt. These flat A umlaut signs are the bars. You get these flat A sounds, they come again and again, and it's just as if the sounds themselves are the bars as the panther flashes past them or walks slowly past them. And that what you get when you speak that poem at the beginning is almost a taste of metal on your mouth. It's almost as if Rilke's way of dealing with that is not to place himself outside the cage and say, isn't it marvelous I'm out here and the panther's in there? He actually becomes the bars themselves. In other words, the soul energy in that moment lies in the bars themselves. And Rilke refuses the diversion, which is to refuse to believe that there are any bars in the world at all, or to plot his escape. Or as I can't remember her name, but marvelous contemporary writer has written, prisons we have made for ourselves. Yes, Doris Lessing, where she says most of our energy actually goes simply into making the prison cell more comfortable. So when we go inside the cage, what we do is rearrange, we take in furniture with us. As the Mayflower van pulls up with us as we arrive to go in the cage. So the fire in this image is the fire of actually facing up to those parts for which we've had very little preparation. And somehow it's connected to our shame, our feeling of not being enough. That somehow there's something wrong with not being enough. The panther image is a good one because, if you look at one of the great icons of modern day spirituality, it's the rainforest. It's the rainforest, this feeling of what we might lose and this feeling of this beckoning uncertainty of a kind of an intangible infinity that's present there in that ecology, and that the way things in a climax ecology such as a rainforest fit together exquisitely, we have a tremendous longing inside us for that to also be able to fit together exquisitely, to know our shape in the world, our gestalt in the world. But when we come to a rainforest as human beings, it's much easier for us to identify with the panther in the rainforest, or the big cat, the thing that eats other things, than it is for us to deal with the leaf mold that's devouring the forest and that is helping to the forest to decay. Our leaf mold consciousness is not very highly developed. Our panther consciousness is the wish to leap, the CEO with the corner office, and the profit-sharing plan. So, to my mind, one does not enter into these fading parts or these grief-filled parts in an indulgent way, a kind of in a way, just to revel in the grief side of things. It's simply that we're trying to reconstitute an inner ecology which is equal to the magnificence of the outer one in which we live. And in some ways, we're destroying that outer ecology because we will not accept the way things fit together inside ourselves either. And we will not accept the leaf mold consciousness in the world, the part that might be fading away or decaying at any one moment. Here's a poem, it's called The Well of Grief, the place one has to go to just at the moment when the paintbrush is about to touch the paper. Those who will not slip beneath the still surface on the well of grief, those who will not slip beneath the still surface on the well of grief, turning down through its black water to the place we cannot breathe, will never know the source from which we drink the secret water, cold and clear, nor find in the darkness glimmering the small round coins thrown by those who wished for something else. Those who will not slip beneath the still surface on the well of grief, turning down through its black water to the place we cannot breathe, will never know the source from which we drink, will never know the source, will never know the source from which we drink the secret water, cold and clear, nor find in the darkness glimmering the small round coins thrown by those who wished for something else. Those who will not slip beneath the still surface on the well of grief, turning down through its black water to the place we cannot breathe, will never know the source from which we drink the secret water, cold and clear, nor find in the darkness glimmering the small round coins thrown by those who wished for something else. When I was in the middle of this poem, I got scared. The image I got, and what happened was, because I got scared, the strategic mind came in to save me. So what the strategic mind says is, I will make you safe. Strategic mind says, I will make you safe against life. And what the soul says is, you already are safe. You're safe in your own experience. But when the fear comes in, the strategic mind says, hold on, what is this? It sees this image. What happened was, this image of gold coins was down there. I was ready to write a long poem on grief. And suddenly, as soon as I saw the coins, part of me knew the poem was over. And the strategic mind inside me said, wait a minute, what is this image of coins? Out, image of coins. You are standing between me and the Pulitzer. I'm... At that point, there was what we call a creative block, an intimation of death on the part of the structural identity which had been built up to that point. Because what that was, you see, here we have the well. We have this image of the well is so deep inside us. You hardly get a story told without a well in it, or a spring, a place where you drink from. And in the west of Ireland, you still get holy wells which are decorated. In Derbyshire, just a stone's throw away from where I grew up in the north of England, they still dress the wells every Easter with marvelous, intricate, very finely done petal paintings. They're almost like tapestries of flower petals, which wonderfully fade away and die. These exquisite things just fall away within weeks. But it's a fallback from the, you know, it's a fallback to the time when the sacred spring was integrated into the culture fully. And all all the great religious traditions, at one point or another, there's an immersion in water where you go back down to the place you cannot breathe, to the wet place in the world, the place where fecundity comes from, where new life comes from, the place, the womb, and you emerge again in the new life. It's interesting, you know, if we're lucky now, we get a touch on the forehead when we're born. But for most of us, the experience is that you come to a well and you throw down a coin and make a wish, you see. That's where we've got to in the story. And the wish is that you do not have to go down the well yourself. The wish is for immunity. So suddenly, those who will not slip beneath the still surface on the well of grief, turning down through its black water to the place we cannot breathe, will never know the source from which we drink the secret water, cold and clear, nor find in the darkness glimmering the small round coins thrown by those who wish for something else. These coins were all the coins I had thrown down previously in my life. In the vain hope that I would not have to actually, physically, go there and be there and live there myself. It's one of the first poems written in English, at least a kind of English, Anglo-Saxon Beowulf. 1500 years ago deals with this necessity of descent into the lake, into the well of grief, into the waters of one's own disowned side, the side of life that you refuse to believe actually also exists in you, the harsher side of life. It's interesting looking at the modern ecological movement and the images of the earth as mother, which is true, I feel. So the earth is a tremendous mother. But Thomas Perry, a great theologian, has also said that the earth will also kill you as soon as look at you. And so in the ecological movement, we might see that a disowned side of the ecological movement would be the ability to also take on that part of the earth. And certainly if you live in Bangladesh right now, you understand that component of the universe very intimately at the moment. But we all experience it one way or another. You know, people we know and love suddenly aren't there one year, or even one day they're gone. Friendships we had disappear, even though both of you are still alive. For some reason they're gone. Creative abilities we had wither and die. Opportunities we had for when certain windows of experience were open in our life, close again. Other ones open, but that one never opens in the same way again. And it's astonishing to look at our psyches and see how much energy we put into defending against those truths. In my mind, one kind of diagnostic feature of a creative block is this tension in your body. You know that tension you feel? Like this. My feeling is it's because it's two equal and opposite forces. That the force of our creativity is so tremendous inside us. The soul force. It's like this gravity well which is constantly pulling us towards it. But this part of us is willing to accept all of life as it is, all the different parts, from the loving mother to the devouring mother, from the loving father to the devouring father, from the waters of nourishment to the fire of metamorphosis and consuming. But that the strategic part of us, which wants to arrange how things are, has taken such a place in our consciousness that it uses all our energy to keep that door closed. Because it does not want to die. And it intuitively knows it will if you follow your paintbrush or your pen. So we get this equal and opposite reaction. You know that feeling when you first open a creative door and you have that tremendous first day in it? So this is incredible. You open the door and then you suddenly get to a point in it where the abyss opens up and you close the door again. And you say, I just need to do a few more workshops to prepare for this. Or maybe 3 years of school, which is code for I never want to open this door again in my life. It's too frightening. The idea is that you are not enough as you are. In some ways, we won't allow ourselves to limp through the initiatory door. We carry the panther consciousness, the Rambo consciousness, into places where it doesn't belong. So back in the 6th century, Beowulf was the equivalent of a Dark Age consultant. You can tell I've been working in the corporate world, can't you? And he and the flower of Anglo-Saxon military society used to hire themselves out to various kings around Europe, around England, which was made up of many kingdoms then, and sought out problems. And they'd heard about this green creature in Denmark that would come out of the lake at night. And it would come and attack King Hrothgar's court, the king of Denmark. And after all the feasting was over and the ring giving and the sword giving and the poems and poetry and storytelling was over and everyone was asleep, this green preacher would come into the court, fight off all the best warriors, cause mayhem, drag off young boys and maidens to the swamp. There'd just be trails of blood and dismembered bodies on the way to the place where Grendel lived. The green creature was Grendel. And so Beowulf turned up on the shores of Denmark. Hrothgar said, "Why have you come?" He said, "To rid you of Grendel." He said, "He lives over there, that way." So Beowulf goes, fights with Grendel, kills Grendel. So they have the feast, they have the ring giving again, they have the sword giving, half his kingdom. This happens exactly today in the consulting world. This happens. The consultants breeze in, they bring in these wonderful ideas, and the thing looks as if it's cleared up right away. And the CEO has this congratulatory moment where he hands, you know, out the pays the bill, gives out the pension plan in the corner office, whatever it is. You know, these mythic realities are exactly the same today, except that night when all the warriors are asleep, something else comes out of the swamp, fights off the best warriors, even the Anglo-Saxon warriors, drags off young men and women to the swamp. Grendel's mother. These stories, very precise, very clear. See, we have this outer ledger sheet in the world, and then we go into the inner world, we think, well, it's kind of vague and woolly in there. You just throw yourself in there and give it the best shot and hope it turns out right. But actually, the mythic and poetic traditions say it's equally precise. It works in a different way, but it's equally precise. There's a bottom line in the inner world, too. So what the story's saying is, it's not the thing you fear, it's the mother of the thing you fear. It's the place where the fear comes from. And Grendel's mother lives, interestingly enough, surprisingly, in a lake. A mere, M-E-R-E, still called the meres in the north of England. Good old Anglo-Saxon word, Windermere, Kentmere. This is the description the bard tells of the place where you have to go to wrestle with Grendel's mother. He says, "They called the huge one Grendel. If he had a father, no one knew him. Or if there are others before them, hidden evil before hidden evil, they live in secret places, windy cliffs, wolf dens, where water pours from rocks, then runs underground, where mist steams like black clouds, and the groves of trees hanging out over their lake are all covered with frozen spray, and hang down snake-like roots that reach as far as the water and help keep it dark. At night, that lake burns like a torch. No one knows its bottom. No wisdom reaches such depths. A deer, hunted through the woods by packs of hounds, a stag with great horns, though driven through the forest from faraway places, refuses to save its life in that water, prefers to die on that shore. It is not far from here, nor is it a pleasant spot." The English were into understatement even 1,500 years ago. "It is not far from here, nor is it a pleasant spot." But actually the bard is saying, if you think this is just a story, don't fool yourself, he says. Don't fool yourself, warriors. "It is not far from here, nor is it a pleasant spot. They call the huge one Grendel. If he had a father, no one knew him. Or if there are others before them, hidden evil before hidden evil." It says you can talk about your mother, you can talk about your father, you can talk about what happened when you were 7 years old. You will never get to the bottom of it. When it's happening is now. Those things can help you, but they will not take you down into the lake. First of all, you must take responsibility, take it on yourself. Here I am now, how do I deal with it? They called the huge one Grendel. If he had a father, no one knew him. Or if there are others before them, hidden evil before hidden evil. They live in secret places, windy cliffs, wolf dens, where water pours from rocks and runs underground, where mist steams like black clouds, and the groves of trees hanging out over their lake are all covered with frozen spray, and wind down snake-like roots that reach as far as the water and help keep it dark. incredible description of being creatively blocked and numb. The frozen branches over the lake. You know that feeling? Frozen branches over the lake. And then this tremendous intimation that somehow the darkness of the lake is fed from above. That somehow we have an investment in it being obscure, in it being blocked itself. That somehow there's some defense there. Wind down snake-like roots that reach as far as the water and help keep it dark at night. That lake burns like a torch. No one knows its bottom. No wisdom reaches such depths. The ordinary mind will not take you down here, the bard says, the story says, the myth says, the poem says. The ordinary strategic mind will not take you into this lake. It can't. It doesn't even know what to do when it gets in there. A deer, hunted through the woods by packs of hounds, a stag with great horns, though driven through the forest from faraway places, refuses to save its life in that water, prefers to die on that shore. It is not far from here, nor is it a pleasant spot. Story says that this lake can be so terrifying to us, to our sense of safety, that we will prefer to die on the shore. Rather than go in there. Interesting. Not only a deer, but a stag. This image of male courage. Stag has been the archetypical image of maleness. It's interesting. Of all the warriors, Beowulf is the only one who can go down and wrestle with Grendel's mother. None of the others can go down. Let's take a break, and I want to talk about what Beowulf might have that allows him to go down to the lake to wrestle with Grendel's mother. Let's take 10 minutes.